At first, should he chase down and try to get a 1.5 amp slow blow? Maybe you could help him out with that, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
Yeah, usually there's a good reason that a manufacturer has put a slow blow resistor in that part of the circuit. And if you put in something else, let me double check it. Yeah, I got mine. If I make the mistake of turning off my speech clipper, as you can see, I sound like I'm talking to a bale of cotton. There's a Kenwood 711 that I'm using, TS711A. It's got a beautiful speech clipper built into it, from my point of view. I like the sound of my voice better with that speech processor. There's usually a good reason. You might have, say, for instance, a capacitor input rectifier power supply, where under working conditions, the power supply is going to draw 400 milliamps. But when those capacitors are thoroughly uncharged, at the instant you first turn on the on-off switch, if Con Ed or Loco or LIPA happen to be at the peak of voltage at that instant you close the switch, the circuit that normally draws 0.4 ampere might draw 15 amperes of inrush current, and maybe more. As such, the slow blow half amp fuse can handle that very nicely, a 13 amp inrush, as long as it doesn't last for more than a second, we'll say. You try to put any other fuse in there as a fast flow, until you get up to 13 amperes, you're always going to be blowing that resistor. And if you did put a 10 ampere fuse in there on a circuit that normally draws 0.4 ampere, you're not getting very much protection. So if the circuit was well designed and really needed a slow blow, I'd go through the effort of finding that slow blow. And by the way, when you do buy slow blows, I think there's more than...
Repeater, timeout.
As I was saying, when you do buy slow blows, I think they come in various time constants of slow blow. So choosing the right brand name and the right model number might be required. I see the possibility of a slow blow. Let me drop. I see the possibility of a slow blow resistor rated for 0.5 ampere, as long as less than 1 second, can tolerate 15 amps of inrush current, whereas another one maybe only can tolerate 10 amperes. So not only slow blow, I try to get the right brand name and model number of slow blow. Don't think there's a good way most of the time of using a non-slow blow resistor there and getting the right protection, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. As you know, sometimes people will put a penny behind the fuse in an old-fashioned fuse box. If you're doing that for the next 10 minutes while you're carefully monitoring everything, maybe you'll survive. You put a penny behind a fuse and you leave it that way, or you're asking for trouble. And people have done that and burned down a house. Over to you, John.
Good words, Dick. KC2WGB, absolutely. Don't do that. Oh, under no circumstances. And I believe the difference, if you notice, there is time delay fuse and slow blow fuse. The time delay fuse has a lump of clamped metal on the web of the fuse, which absorbs heat and allows it to have that time delay. The slow blows not only have a slow blow element, but they also have a spring which pulls them apart on many of them. So that's the difference I noticed between those two. But there could be quite a few others. All right, that's it from the mailbag, and I think we should go on to Lou's question. Maybe we could help him out with that and have some fun. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
And Trio, John, is it possible for me to ask a quick question after Lou?
Dick, you want to take that?
Well, let's find out how long it takes us to answer the question. By the way, to make sure I've got the question as best that you know about it, John, Lou's question about cosmic microwave background measurements, read that to me to make sure we know a little bit of the flavor of the physics department of, if I know correctly, this is, why can't I think of the name of the school, on Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn Tech. I presume it's the physics department of Brooklyn Tech that's asking this particular question. So read it to me, John. K KC2WGB, KQIW, the Tech Man.
Dick, I'm not prepared to do that because I don't have that up on the screen. I can't get at that right now. But basically, from what I remember, is they're asking about developing an antenna to be able to receive that. I believe they have a receiver that they're going to use, but they need to develop an antenna that's going to do it. But I think you have a good idea there in your other noise areas that may suffice. So let's see what Rich has to ask, and if it's not too long, maybe you could take care of that, and then we'll go over the loop.
Is it a brief question that you think you've got, Rich, in 2EO, KQIW?
I think so, Dick. This is N2EO. Dick, I'll be buying those pair of 3500Zs next week. But I want you to know the brand new tubes made in China, you know, they're by that company, Taylor Tubes. And I'd like to know if there's any wake-up procedure, because you mentioned that. Should I leave it on idling? I can, what I can do after I put the tubes in is let it idle overnight, get up in the morning, and apply drive. Is that necessary? Take over.
It's a good thing to do, Rich. It's belt and suspenders. Any transmitting tube that has been sitting for a long time on the shelf could experience a small amount of outgassing of the elements within the tube, even though the glass envelope is perfect and no leakage of air going in from the outside world is happening. Every tube has a certain rate of outgassing depending on how clean were the elements inside the tube during the time of manufacture. So therefore, the wake-up procedure of using nothing but filament with the blower, if there is one, running for some number of hours before you hit the tube with high voltage the first time, it's a good thing to do, particularly with traveling wave tubes. But many other kind of transmitting tubes benefit from that so-called wake-up procedure. Now, the tubes that you are about to buy are brand new. The tubes that are in there right now are slightly old and slightly gassy. If the tubes that are in there right now, if they happen to be brand new and the thing is able to put out a kilowatt key down, and they're only putting out 790 watts key down, that's so bad. That's exactly 1 dB down, 1/6 of an S unit. Unless the guy that you're talking to is making a very careful measurement on a well-calibrated S meter, he'd never know this difference. So if your old tubes can put out 790, do you have to buy brand new tubes at this time? And 2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Well, as I just said last week, whenever I buy a used piece of equipment, I like to restore it and start all fresh. Me and Barry, I got it from him. We don't know the history of this thing. He bought it on eBay from a guy in Canada who used it for a short time and sold it to me. Barry suspects that the tubes are bad. I want to put in a new set of tubes and a new set of parasitic chokes, because he said when he would tune it up, he would hear thump, 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 and then...
Okay, I see where you're going, and I see your motivation, and as long as you're not shy on funds, and the tubes are not that expensive, go for it. But if the old tubes are there, and they are giving you some funny effects, because they're gassy, and maybe the gettering inside those tubes will do its thing in the next hour of operation, and maybe there's a wake-up procedure required for those tubes. Just the fact that the tubes are not brand new doesn't mean they don't need wake-up, because they've been sitting on the shelf for a long time. So the old tubes, operating for a length of time, might get better, they might get worse. The chances of them doing some kind of permanent damage to your amplifier is very slim. They can burn up the parasitic choke if they go into oscillations. They can put some extra grief on your diode rectifiers, but your diode rectifiers are fairly easy to replace, even if they get blown, and so on. And the chances of you destroying the main power transformer, that's the most expensive component there. The chances of the bad tubes, with you watching the dials, destroying that power transformer is very slim. So I see nothing wrong with operating that amplifier with the old slightly questionable tubes. But that's me. Maybe I'm cheap. Okay, let me stand by and I'm going to go over to the next question. 2, a person working in a physics department. The most pure sound in the world of random noise generators, you would think, is the cosmic microwave background. The best thing that we can read these days is that the belief is that 13.7 billion years ago, there was a great big bang. All of the stuff in our observable universe supposedly was in one single spot at that time. Some form of instability occurred, a big bang occurred, and the stuff at a good fraction of the speed of light, and maybe even beyond, the stuff got spread out. At the instant of the big bang, the temperature was close to infinity, and so now for 13.7 billion years, all of the material of this observable universe, 2 times 10 to the 11 stars per galaxy, roughly 2 times 10 to the 11 galaxies that are observable, all of that stuff that used to be in one spot is now spreading out at a whole distribution of velocities in all possible directions. And for 13.7 billion years, it has been expanding and cooling off. Let me drop. So Mr. Penzias and Mr. Wilson made the second, from my point of view, galactic measurement. The very first galactic measurement was done by Mr. Jansky. Carl Jansky, 1932, was hired by Bell Laboratories, I think it was, or ITT. And they knew that there was some noise coming over the horizon to their radio circuits, their HF radio circuits. And so he was asked to find out where the hell is that noise coming from. So he builds this great big Sturber curtain antenna. The thing must be 22 or 25 feet long from left to right, and is a zigzagging of wire in there, acting as a driven element, as a reflector, a pair of them. And this whole thing is mounted on automobile wheels, 4 of them, so that the whole thing can be rotated. So he builds this Sturber curtain antenna operating at something close to 18 megacycles, as I remember. Resonant antenna, directional antenna, and he starts rotating it, and he finds out the direction where he gets maximum noise. It records that. For some reason, he made the measurement a number of days in a row, just to see if the noise goes up and down from day to day. Let me drop. And not only did he see the thing going up and down a little bit from day to day, he found that the peak of the noise, the direction of arrival, was continuously shifting. And that got his curiosity. And he kept making the measurement long enough to find out it was just shifting at approximately 1 degree per day. What the hell continuously changes for many days in a row, 1 degree per day? That happens to be the rate at which the Earth goes around the Sun. We move 360 degrees in 365 days. Suddenly realized for that rate of shift of the peak of the signal, it just happens to match the rate at which the Earth goes around the Sun. He said, aha, that is not a terrestrial source. It's an extraterrestrial source. That was the very first measurement, confirmed measurement, of an extraterrestrial source. We now know that what he was measuring was the center of our galaxy, where all those black holes are located. So there's a lot of jazz going on there, a lot of heat and emotion, and a lot of moving stars, big stars moving in a hurry, and black holes. So there's a lot of stuff going on at the center of our galaxy. I think it's called Cygnus X, but anyhow, so he located that source in 1932. Beautiful radio astronomy measurement. But the world of radio astronomy hasn't been invented yet. Let me drop. So he had enough curiosity to measure the change in noise power and the change of direction of arrival. And then for reasons that are mysterious to me, he dropped the project. He wasn't interested beyond that point. He had fulfilled his requirement. And along came Groke Reber in roughly 1938, 6 years later, and picked up the ball. He eventually built this 31 or 32 foot diameter parabolic dish antenna in his backyard in Wheaton, Illinois. W9, I can't remember his call letters right now. And he made a whole lot of measurements with the best stuff he could get a hold of along those days, in those days, which were acorn tubes. You know that he went higher in frequency, had more gain out of his antenna, but whatever the source of noise got weaker as you went higher. So he had a conflict of interest. By modern day standards, he had very high noise figures and couldn't easily make those measurements. But he did. He published some star charts. And so Reber was our first real radio astronomer. However, in Carl Chansky's honor, the basic source of noise from the universe is called a Chansky unit, which I think is 10 to the minus 22 watts per square meter per cycle per second. Watts per square meter per hertz. I think it's 10 to the minus 22 or 10 to the minus 24 is the standard unit called a Chansky, which is used today for making radio astronomy noise power measurements. Let me drop.
Nick, what frequency was he working at Bell Labs?
Somewhere around 18 megacycles, John.
Okay.
That Sterba curtain of his, which, by the way, that antenna was moved to the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, Green Bank, West Virginia. You visit that National Radio Astronomy site, and you will see those two antennas. You'll see Carl Chansky's antenna, beautifully restored and maintained. You'll see Groke Reber's 31-foot diameter parabolic dish antenna, beautifully restored and maintained. So the first two serious radio astronomy antennas, the actual real item made by the hands of that scientist, is there. In fact, whenever the Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers, SARA, S-A-R-A, whenever they have a meeting, all of those people will gather together, and they gather about 50, 70 people once per year in June to have a meeting, and they will either stand in front of Carl Chansky's antenna or Groke Reber's antenna in order to take that group photograph. Let me drop. The next serious radio astronomy measurement was done by, can't think of his name right now, in World War II, somewhere around 1943-44, the radars we were using at that time started seeing some strange noise in a particular direction. Well, the sun was doing some kind of a solar prominence, and so it was starting to show up on radar screens. And so, can't think of the guy's name, as I said, who finally figured out what it was. In the beginning, they thought the Germans had invented some kind of a brand new radar jammer, but they soon realized that it was coming from the sun because of the direction of arrival changing at the rate of 15 degrees per hour, the rate at which the Earth changes, the Earth rotates. So that was the next step. That was the very first time that solar noise was measured with a radar set during World War II with a crystal diode front end. It was probably done at X-band, if I know them, or maybe S-band, one or the other. We didn't have enough sensitivity before then without a solar prominence to be able to see sun noise. A modern-day radio telescope, the loudest thing there is in that universe most of the time, and you saw 99% of the time, is that sun. It's running at 5,000 degrees Kelvin, surface temperature, and it makes a lot of radio noise when you're using modern sensitive radio equipment. Let me drop. So, in roughly 1967, the next level of measurements was done by Arlo Penzias and Mr. Wilson. Penzias and Wilson, working at Bell Laboratories, using this very fancy horn antenna. They had invented a very high-performance horn antenna, and in order to do Project Echo is where you take a mylar balloon, I don't know what the diameter was, probably 20 or 40 feet in diameter, you put it into space, and this mylar reflective balloon was going to be a passive repeater. And now you take this extremely high gain, very low side lobe, hog horn antenna, aim it at that balloon, and the echo you get off of it is now going to be a passive repeater by which when the moon can be seen, when this satellite, when this balloon can be seen during the time that the balloon is halfway between Europe and the United States, now you get direct communication between the two at microwave frequencies. Good sounding project. Didn't work very well for about three reasons. One, the echo you get off that balloon, unless it's a monstrous thing in diameter, is very weak. Second of all, because it's moving at 17,500 miles an hour, you don't get a very long window where the two of you can talk to each other. Let me drop.
That was about 100 feet in the diameter, that WS one.
Okay, and was that called Project Echo? What was the name of that? And that came before Project Westfall. I think it was called Project Echo, and 100 feet in diameter. Oh, boy. which means it's a very large target. It's a very short period of time going to come along before a meteor or a piece of space junk, something is going to hit it, puncture it, and the balloon starts collapsing, and pretty soon as an echoing device, as a nice round shiny balloon, it ain't there anymore. Give us a couple of words on what you remember from, I think it's called Project Echo. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
It was the Bell Lab project, early 1960, probably 1960. I remember it had some solar cells on it, and NICAD batteries in those days. And again, you would just reflect your signal off it, and the signal would come back. So it was a passive thing. But they put it in orbit. I forgot how long it stayed up there, but it did work. But, you know, it was a great experiment, and it's amazing that they're trying to do the same type of thing, except for living quarters, and that's going to be the BEAM project coming up soon. So it's an inflatable thing that just floated around in space after it was launched. Back to you, Dick.
So we are with info.
It didn't just float around in space, Paul. It was in a very specific orbit, predictable ahead of time. You knew exactly where it was going to be when, so therefore you make a schedule between you and, say, for instance, the Judrell Bank 250-foot dish. You aim that at it at the same time that you aim this Hargorn antenna. We had one in Maine, and the original antenna was set up at Holmdel, New Jersey, and I visited that site. And if you Google the word Penzias and Wilson, and first background noise measurement, that particular antenna is considered a national monument, and it will never be destroyed. It's going to sit there at Holmdel forever. There's a great big sign alongside of it, because that was a very significant measurement that was made at that time. You got a couple of words to add to this one, Rich, N2EO, K2RIW.
All right, Dick, this WS2N, it was a 600-mile orbit, and highly inclined, I think 80 or 85-degree inclination, so everybody got a chance to use it if they wanted to.
Very fine, that ball. Very fine, Paul. We're going to send it over to Rich next, and then there's another person on EchoLink that's going to give us some words. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, it had to be earlier than 1960, probably 1957, as I recall, because I was a sleepaway camp at the time that my parents sent me. And we had a camp out on a mountaintop in upstate New York, Mount Beacon, New York. I remember when we went to sleep, looked at the sky, I could see the echo balloons going overhead. Dick, over.
The very first thing that was put into Earth orbit was the Russian Sputnik, 1957. I would guess somewhere around September, October, 1957. The very next thing put into orbit was another Sputnik, and then some of the Laika, the dog. The Russians put a number of things in orbit. We eventually put up the Vanguard that measured the Van Allen belt measurements 1 or 2 years later. The Echo project had to be later than 57. It took us a couple of years to be able to launch things in space. So I think it was early 60s. But we'll settle on that. There's another person on Echo Link that wants to give us some words. Please give us your call letters and your name, and then your words. K2RIW, Echo TechNet. My name is Dick.
One second, that it was 1960, and there was another one, Echo 2, that followed soon after. And you're right about 57, October 4th.
October 4th, 57, was Sputnik. But Echo, I think you're saying, was 1960. Is that what you're saying, Paul? Go ahead.
USO. And the Vanguard is the one that, we tried to launch it. It blew up on a pad, and we followed it up with Explorer. And that was the one, that was successful with the Van Allen belts. All cool history. Back to you, Dick.
Vanguard was what year, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, we rushed it after probably the end of 57, maybe January of 58, and then in 58 we got a a couple of months later. That's when we used the Juno rocket to launch Echo, not Echo, Explorer up there. That's the time frame. You know, that started the whole race, and we haven't stopped since.
354. Now, the person that was talking to us in Echo Link, please give us your call letters, your name, and then proceed with your piece of information. K2RIW, my name is Dick. John, did that person sign in that shows up on your screen? Over to you, John.
No, Dick, I didn't see anything indicate there was anybody transmitting. Maybe it was IRLP.
I'm giving a nice long delay in case somebody wants to give us some further words. So, the next thing that Bell Labs was asked to find out is that we're hearing a continuous, very low-level noise on our radio circuits. We know where the center of the galaxy is. We know what solar noise is like. If at midnight you still see some residual noise, and you're looking in the direction away from the galaxy, where the heck is that noise coming from, and how loud is it? So Mr. Penzias and Wilson, using this well-recognized, extremely high-performance, hardcore antenna. What's unique about that antenna is by its design. Its side lobes are 45 or 50 dB down. Any normal antenna has front-to-back ratio and side lobes that are numbers like 13, 15, 17 dB down. This very fancy antenna has side lobes that are 45 or 50 dB down. I can direct you to a website in which you can see the exact measured performance of that antenna, and it's out of sight compared to any antenna that came along before then. So using this state-of-the-art, edge-of-the-art antenna at the cutting edge, the bleeding edge of antenna design, with an extremely well-defined main lobe and nothing else that you can reasonably see in that antenna pattern, using that antenna, aiming it into various directions in the sky, they saw some residual noise. They had instrumentation that could get down to cryogenic temperatures. They had a cryogenically cooled low-noise amplifier in the front end of that receiver on this hardcore antenna at the Homedale, New Jersey. And they were seeing some residual noise. In the beginning, they thought it was the pigeon droppings inside the horn, and they clicked
repeater, timeout.
And they cleaned out all the pigeon droppings. Made no difference. And that doesn't surprise me. Because when I built my first dual-mode feed horn for that stressed parabolic 12-foot diameter antenna that runs at 2.3 gigahertz that I use for Apollo reception, you can read about that in August 1972 QST magazine. When I first built that antenna, I painted it with silver paint because it was made out of food cans and paint cans. And I worried about the thickness of the paint creating extra insertion loss. I did a whole bunch of procedures to measure the insertion loss of the paint. With what I now know, the paint was what? Less than a thousandth of an inch in diameter, and I'm operating at a 4.8 inch wavelength. So what percentage of a wavelength is that paint? It's not even the, 0.0001%. And no matter what the paint is made out of, the lossiest paint in the world, when it's that thin, you try to make insertion loss because of that thickness, and you couldn't do it. If you try to build an anechoic chamber, and you're using something that's a thousandth of an inch thick, and you want absorption at 2.3 gigs, 2.4 gigs, you're wasting your time. You ain't going to get it. Let me drop it. I'm not sure of the exact frequency that Penzias and Wilson made their first measurement, but it could very well have been around 2.3 gigs. Because in those days, they had available to them cryogenically cooled parametric amplifiers that can get down to some very low noise figures. So they worried about the pigeon droppings, and they cleaned it out. Made no difference. No difference in the world. Unless the pigeon droppings were half a foot thick, they wouldn't be able to measure it. Well, let me go. That's a little bit. Unless it was about an inch and a half. If the pigeon droppings were an inch thick, a quarter of a wavelength, yes, you would have been able to see some difference in performance. But pigeon droppings don't get evenly smeared across your horn a quarter of an inch thick. Not a chance. So that wasn't it. So they measured this amount of residual noise that was beyond the noise created by the low noise front end. They soon realized that every direction in space that they aim, they see roughly the same amount of noise, as long as they're not aimed at the sun, as long as they're not aimed at a major star, Cygnus X, Cassiopeia, the known large sources of radio noise. As long as they're not aimed at one of those, they saw this constant background noise, which became called 3 degrees Kelvin. Today is now known to be 2.714 degrees Kelvin. 2.713, yeah, I think it's 2.713 degrees Kelvin, plus or minus 0.01 degree Kelvin. Let me drop. Now, when it comes to radio astronomy, you're not talking about a signal strength that you measure in dBm. If I turn on my signal generator and turn the dial down real low, I might get down to minus 120 on the dial. And by various techniques of well shielding and other attenuators, I can get down to numbers like minus 160, minus 170 dBm of a sine wave signal. But all of that stuff going on in space, with rare exception, does not make a sine wave signal. It makes broadband noise. Gaussian-shaped noise in amplitude distribution, noise that falls off at roughly 20 dB per octave, or is it? Yeah, I think it's 20 dB per octave as you go up in frequency. So the noise has got a very known slant. It's called black body noise. It's called many things. But 2.7, 713 degrees Kelvin. The amount, so radio astronomy doesn't rate noise power in dBm. They rate it in degrees Kelvin. Let me drop that. If I take a 50 ohm resistor, which is impedance matched to my particular amplifier, and if I put the resistor in there at room temperature, which we usually call 290 degrees Kelvin, I get a given amount of noise, and noise power is measured in dBm per megahertz of bandwidth. When it comes to broadband noise, you have to define the bandwidth over which you're making the measurement. Let me drop. By the way, if you guys will listen to the input, we can find out where that source of noise is coming from. By listening to the input frequency and reporting it to LabRock.org, they'd like to hear from you as to where do you think the noise is coming from. T2RIW standing by. So, radio astronomers will rate the noise power, the brightness, the hotness, call it what you like, of a radio source in degrees Kelvin. A room temperature resistor, 290 degrees Kelvin, puts out a given amount of noise, very close to minus 114 dBm per megacycle of bandwidth. Go to half a megacycle of bandwidth, you'll get half that amount of noise power. So it's a uniform distribution, so to speak, over small bandwidth. So radio astronomy sources are rated in degrees Kelvin. That's the way you rate signal strength. And so my 50 ohm resistor sitting on the bench, if it's impedance matched to my receiver, and my receiver is well calibrated, I'll measure amount of random noise coming out of the molecules of my 50 ohm resistor. My 50 ohm resistor is made out of, let's say, carbon granules or nichrome wire or whatever. It's a whole bunch of individual molecules in there. Depending on the physical temperature of those molecules, they're in a matrix because it's a solid. They're locked in position, but they're shaking in position as if they're mounted on springs. So each of those individual molecules are shaking a predictable amount. Depending on the physical temperature, you can measure with a thermometer. The electrons that are connected to those metals are also being shaken. And as you shake those resistors, as you shake those electrons, you're making random noise. And the random noise is a very exact formula. And so Mr. Fries, among other people, measured that noise. And he came up with procedures for measuring the quality of an amplifier called noise figure. Let me drop this. So, you tell me the temperature of your resistor. If your resistor is impedance matched to the front end of the receiver, in theory, I can tell you with extreme accuracy exactly how many volts or microvolts or nanovolts of noise power you're going to get out of that resistor if you tell me the bandwidth of your receiver, dBm per megahertz. So minus 114 is room temperature. Go go down to a temperature of 2.73 degrees Kelvin, which is 100 times lower. You're going to measure 20 some odd dB less than minus 114. You're going to measure minus 134, minus 135 dBm. So the amount of noise power coming from the cosmic microwave background is something in the vicinity of minus 135 dBm per megahertz. Is that a weak signal? Oh boy, is that weak. But with the right kind of instrumentation, with the right kind of very elaborately produced antenna, you can make that measurement. You can find out how much of it is coming from the back lobes of your antenna, even though the back lobes are 50 dB down, and you can figure out how much is really coming from space. Let me drop. So it is easy to say that of all the signal strengths that mankind measures today, other than the Voyager spacecraft at 12 billion miles away, transmitting something like 10 watts or so of power, which is an extremely weak signal, one of the weakest signals we can measure is cosmic microwave background radiation. Because all of that material of the Big Bang, 13.7 billion years ago, has been spreading away from us and cooling off. And although it started off at a zillion degrees Kelvin, at the instant of the Big Bang, 13 billion years later, it has gotten down to 2.713, 2.714, degrees Kelvin, very, very cold. We're getting down to real cryogenic temperatures, cooler than liquid helium. There are very few refrigerators that can get down to that temperature. It's cold. That signal noise is very, very weak. So, for the science department of Brooklyn Tech High School, if that's who it is, or a college, to decide to measure cosmic microwave background radiation as a source of random noise. Unless you're extremely well equipped, you're not going to be able to measure that. And the quality of that noise as far as Gaussian distribution of amplitude and phase, or its distribution in space as far as angle of arrival is concerned, there's nothing magic about that particular noise as far as a random number generator is concerned. There's various people who have written articles. Let me drop it. Various people have written articles saying that when you see the white noise on your old-fashioned amplitude-modulated television receiver of 20 years ago, some of that noise is background radiation of space. People have said those words. They weren't lying, but there's a problem, and let me show you the problem. Assume that you and your father go to Yankee Stadium on the last day of the World Series. This is the sixth game of the World Series. And to get a ticket, damn difficult. So you got a ticket for yourself, and you managed to get one more ticket for your father. But your father's ticket was 10 rows back from third base. And your ticket is 10 rows back from first base. So you're in the opposite sides of this stadium during the sixth game of the World Series. And you didn't bring your cell phone with you. Your father has his cell phone. And he gets a call from home that something going on at home is pretty significant, and you and your father have to take care of it. So your father decides to shout across Yankee Stadium that, hey, something's going on. However, Murphy's Law dictates that that's going to take place in the bottom of the ninth inning when the score is tied and the batter has just hit a home run. Let me drop this. So here you are, the sixth game of the World Series, tied score, bottom of the ninth. The batter hits a home run. He's about to start running around the bases, and that crowd is going wild. They're jumping up and down, screaming and hollering, and your father, across Yankee Stadium, is trying to shout a message to you, and you make a tape recording of that sound. Is his voice there? Absolutely. His voice just happens to be 1/10,000th, there's 35,000 people in that stadium, and one of them is shouting a message to you from across the stadium. The chances of hearing him are pretty darn slim. Very. You make a recording. Is his noise there? Is his voice in that noise? Oh, yeah. Can you specifically measure it? Not exactly. You could run an experiment during the time that all the people are jumping up and down and cheering. that he emitted with some kind of an audio generator, exactly an 803 hertz note, very exact audio signal generator, an 803 hertz. And you've got a very narrowband audio receiver tuned to exactly 803 hertz, and your receiver is either 1 hertz wide or a tenth of a hertz wide or a millihertz wide. You use the right receiver with a narrow enough bandwidth, you will hear that very specific high spectral purity tone in all of that noise. Let me drop. So with that tone, if he now sends very slow speed CW while all those people are cheering, yes, you can get that message through. That's essentially what Voyager is doing. Voyager is out there at 8.5 gigahertz, transmitting an extremely coherent, very narrowband signal that's being modulated in a digital manner at roughly 50 bits per second. And with this 240-foot diameter dish at Goldstone, California, they're listening to that signal with an extremely narrowband, very precisely tuned receiver, and they're getting that signal. So you can see the degree of similarity here. So when it comes to broadband noise from the universe, it's such a weak signal compared to all the noise you're going to get from your own resistors, your antenna aimed at the universe, if it's not that precise hoghorn receiver they've got in Homedale, New Jersey, and you can look that one up on the website. Let me drop it. Even that precise antenna with 50 dB downside lobes, and that antenna cost them a couple of megabucks to build it, without that antenna, and even then they had to use correcting procedures to find out how much of the noise coming in that receiver was coming from local terrestrial sources versus the extraterrestrial source of the background radiation of the universe. So you can see that building a receiver to measure that noise, I'm not going to say it's impossible, but I want you to know where the mines are buried in this minefield. You're walking into a minefield. It's a good sounding scientific project, but to really carry it out within the limitations of your resources, boy, you're going to have to work real hard at it. And when you finally do measure that noise, is it any better than the noise you're going to get out of your room temperature resistor or out of the noise front end of your low noise amplifier? Is there any real difference in the distribution of the noise? I think the answer is no. They're both Gaussian-shaped noise. Is one better than the other? And should you go through the heroic effort required to get one over the other? I'm not so sure. Let's see what Lou's got to say about all this, Lou. As you can see, it's a little bit difficult, beautiful, lofty, good science project. N2RQ, if you're there, Lou, and it's your group that's making this request. You got a pretty sharp set of guys there. Over to you, Lou, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Okay, this is amazing. All I can say is I've known you a long time, Dick, and you never cease to amaze me. But I will have to go back. By the way, it is Brooklyn Technical High School on DeKalb Avenue and South Elliott Place and Fort Greene Place. And these are high school students with this project. Rather enlightening. Thank you very much. Over. This is N2RQ.
Very fine, Lou. DeKalb Avenue, which happens to run right by Brooklyn Tech High School. It happens to run by, I think it's the southern end of Pratt Institute. Yeah, I think it's the southern end of Pratt Institute. Ryerson and DeKalb are the intersections at one corner of the place. Not very far from there is Myrtle Avenue and Willoughby Avenue. I lived in Willoughby Walks for a while, the local, which was now student housing. It was then private housing, a 15-story building, and I was on the 11th floor. And I would periodically go up to the roof on the 15th floor, above the 15th floor, to either sun myself or to look over the side. Now, of course, the door is locked. They won't let you do that. So what part of that explanation may have surprised you, Lou? What part of that did you not expect to hear? N2RQ, K2RIW of the TechNet.
Well, I think the overall detail of the signal strength in the background noise is that was revealing to me. Some of the history I knew, and I've actually, by the way, been rather impressed by the personality and stories that Arno Penzias has told when he's been at the school. That's a separate side piece. Back to you.
Wow. Run that by again. So you're saying Mr. Arno Penzias of Bell Laboratories, the guy who made this pivotal measurement for which he and his buddy got a Nobel Prize in Stockholm, Sweden, you're saying he personally visited Brooklyn Tech High School on DeKalb Avenue? Tell me what it was like visiting him, how long ago, and boy, you guys privileged. Give us a few words on that one, Lou. N2RQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. Well, the first time I saw him and heard him, he was at the school for the assembly where they were inducting the Honor Society class that year. And he is an alum. He graduated from Brooklyn Tech. And he, as part of the ceremony, he spoke, and he also showed his home movies, as he called them. His home movies consisted of the official Bell Labs a film of the background of his research and the receiving of the Nobel Prize.
Well done. So he just happens to be a graduate of Brooklyn Tech High School, a local boy that made good. And by the way, name a couple of other famous people that you know of, you can think of at the top of your head, who graduated from Brooklyn Tech High School. I'll bet you the number of Nobel Prizes coming out of that school is probably near the best of all the five boroughs of New York City. Is that true, Lou? N2RQ, K2RIW?
As far as I know, there were only two. The first one, I think, was in biology, and I don't remember the name offhand, but I know some of the alumni been rather prominent. For example, Charles Wang, and I don't remember the name of the head of getting out of the company. Anyway, it's a whole bunch of them. It is a rather amazing. But there is one little anecdote from that ceremony that Arno Penzias did. He asked everyone to get off the stage so that he could show his movie. And the inductees were on the stage. They had to get off. And they turned, and they're walking to the two ends of the stage. And there's a bottleneck. It's a staircase at one end. And one of the students turns around and walks across the stage to the other staircase. And he singled him out as a lesson because it takes something special to go against the crowd.
Well done. Now, one of the other people that we ham radio operators know, if you've ever gone to any major conference where Joe Taylor is giving a talk, K1JT, who got his Nobel Prize for the measurement he made of a pulsar at the Arecibo Ionospheric Observatory, as it was then called. And at a ham radio gathering, he will pass his Nobel Prize emblem around the audience. I'm pretty sure that Mr. Penzias or Wilson couldn't do that because you've got thousands of people in that audience. But in the case of 100 ham radio microwave observers at a conference, Joe Taylor will pass around that medallion. And for some reason, he's very careful to recollect it at the end. I don't understand that. When it comes to Mr. Watson, the guy who, so to speak, discovered the double helix of the DNA molecule while working at Cold Spring Harbor. Let me drop this. He's mentioned in today's issue of Newsday, and he sold his Nobel Prize medallion on a website, and it was purchased by a Russian multimillionaire for $4.15 million. He sold his medallion from the Nobel Prize. And he then spent that $4.5 million to various charities. And pretty soon the Russian rich man realized what was going on, gave him the medallion back, saying, you should keep it, and you don't have to give me the money back, because I now see what you're doing with the money, and I see why you did it. So there's real value in those medallions. So only one of them has ever been sold, to my knowledge, and it sold for over $4 million. So for some reason, Joe Taylor recollects it after he passes it around the audience. And so maybe Mr. Wilson, or Mr. Penzias, whoever it was, visited Brooklyn Tech. He may have flashed that medallion. I suspect he did not get a chance to allow people to pass it around the audience. Is that true, Joe? I mean, Lou? N2RQ, K2RIW?
To my knowledge, he did not pass it around. There are several other stories that he's told, which I'm not going to take up the next time with, but some other time. He's quite an interesting and regular fellow, from what I understand. Anyway, thank you very much. Most informative. And what I need is information on where we can access the recording. Back to you, Dick, which is Mark.
That I don't know. I don't know if there is a website giving you a recording. Back in the days of 1967 or so, when Penzias and Wilson were making these measurements, I don't think we had invented broadband high-speed videotape recordings yet. I think that came some number of years later, when the television industry finally needed them real bad and came up with the helical scan techniques. So I'm not sure that there is a recording that Penzias and Wilson did. Now, Penzias and Wilson made this measurement that all the frequencies that they could use that horn for, all the measurements they could make, they saw a nearly constant temperature in every direction in space at essentially every frequency, 2.714, 2.713 degrees Kelvin. But they couldn't resolve it anywhere near that well then. All they knew is it was in the vicinity of 3 degrees. In the very early days, it was called the 3-degree Kelvin measurement. Let me drop it.
Dick, I think Lou was referring to the recording of the TechNet, if I'm not mistaken.
Is that what you're asking, Lou? Where is the TechNet recorded?
That's correct. I want to be able to share this with the students.
Okay. That was at for the last 10 years of recordings of TechNet. All you got to do is go to Mike Perry's website, KC2NJI, but you don't have to know that. It is at the website of www.amateurradio.tangovictor. No punctuation. Amateur radio, all run together, .tangovictor. You choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and the right recording. Each recording is 1 hour reeled. We're now leaving. We're entering the third hour, so it looks like it's going to be the reel of the second hour. The reel that began in the second hour at some number of minutes downrange, and that reel is the recording that I guess you care about at amateurradio.tangovictor. And some further information about this cosmic microwave background measurements, which are now entering into the third reel, the third hour. That is the very first satellite put into space to make a more precise measurement with COBE. Cosmic Background Explorer, it was called. It made some very nice measurements. It was followed by a much higher resolution, much higher sensitivity satellite called, forgetting the name of the dot, the WMAP, which stands for Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe. The Wilkinson probe, which was about 10 or so years ago, consists of two very precisely made parabolic dishes back-to-back, and this hold-on satellite rotates slowly while making these measurements. And you compare the measurement you make from the front dish compared to the measurement you get from the back dish at all of these frequencies, and you eventually, when you put it all together and integrate just right, you get a very precise measurement. Let me drop.
Give Mike 2's website also, Dick.
Which doesn't have the recording, so I'll give them that too. Mike 2 is the website of K1MJM. that website is LimarkTechnet.com. LimarkTechnet.com has other supporting information that supports the TechNet, but the main one you want is AmateurRadio.TangoVictor, which has the real recording. So, Cosmic Background Explorer made measurements. WMAC, Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, made much more precise measurements, where now you get more decimal places of accuracy, more decimal places of accuracy of the exact amount of noise. Let me drop. And they're really looking for the extremely fine variations of noise power versus direction. That's what anisotropy means. An isotropic source is absolutely uniform in all directions. Well, the background universe is a little bit hotter in some spots and a little bit colder in some spots. How much hotter and how much colder? We're talking about millikelvins and microkelvins. A thousandth of a degree and a millionth of a degree of differences in various directions. They call that the hot spots. You can just barely resolve it. And so much, much higher accuracy was done with WMAP. And then that was followed by a European satellite, which was called Planck, P-L-A-N-C-K, which made more precise measurements yet. So if you Google those words, COBE, WMAP, and Planck, WMAP, M-A-P, W-M-A-P, and Planck, those three satellites got more and more accurate, higher and higher resolution as to the fine details of the cosmic microwave background. And as you get those finer and finer details, let me drop it, you're now able to resolve something about the clumpiness of the raw materials that were present at the instant of the Big Bang. Get some strong hints as to whether or not we are in one universe or a multiverse. There is a significant amount of energy slowly gathering. It was resisted at first, but it's slowly becoming accepted, in my opinion, that we are in a multiverse. For us to sit here and with arrogance, say that there was only one Big Bang in the whole history of the universe, I use the word history in quotes, and there was only one Big Bang, and we just happened to be in the middle of it. What's the chances of that? Not a chance in the world. Not a chance in the universe, as I see it. Not a chance in the multiverse. I am convinced that there have been multiple Big Bangs in other places at other times. The fact that there was only one Big Bang is arrogant. We used to think there was only one planet called Earth, and everything revolved around it. Got humbled to find out that we're just a planet going around the sun. We wanted to think the sun is the center of everything. Well, we found that the sun is part of this island universe called galaxy. We wanted to think that our galaxy was the be-all, end-all. Well, we're a member of a local galactic group, and we thought that galactic group was everything. Well, we're part of a great big universe. So that's the five places we have been, or four or five places we've been humbled so far. And by way of the fine details of the cosmic microwave background, let me drop it. I'm convinced we're about to be humbled for the fifth or sixth time to find out there wasn't just one Big Bang, there isn't just one universe, there are multiple universes, and we are a smaller and smaller particle of the great big picture, if you know what I mean. I'm convinced we will find that out. The fact that those other multiverses are beyond our observable universe doesn't mean that they're not there. You take a look at that ultra deep field, the super deep field, the ultra deep field pictures done by the Hubble Space Telescope, where you aim it in some particular dark direction and you take a picture for 1 million consecutive seconds and you look at all the stuff that's there and you see in that one picture 2,300 galaxies that have never been seen before. And as you look out further and further toward the edge of that observable universe, you would think they would like that those galaxies become very sparse. They do not. Let me drop. The edge of our observable universe may have the same density of galaxies as we've got locally. I don't know if it's exactly that number, but enough. We don't see the end. We see just as many out there as we do nearby. So for you to think, for you and I to think, that we can see everything, not a chance in the universe. Guaranteed there's a lot of stuff beyond our observable universe. looking out there at greater and greater distances, I'm pretty sure we're eventually going to see evidence of other Big Bangs. The clumpiness that you see